This is a No Dabba podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and today I'm joined by Jay Gambetta, a scientist at IBM who works on quantum theory, software, and applications. Jay also took part in episode 82, where we talked about IBM's quantum experience. But Jay, for people who haven't listened to that episode, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, please?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a quantum information scientist researching the field of quantum computing. I joined IBM in 2011 and recently became an IBM fellow this year. I also manage the quantum theory, software, and applications group. I've been doing quantum for about 20 years. I've focused on superconducting qubits, quantum information science, and now I'm getting to the software of quantum computing. I also love that we're building in a community, and I'm currently also the chair of the Division for Quantum Information for the APS, and really try to make sure that we can make quantum possible in the future.
When you say you were recently made a fellow, what does that mean?
Yeah, I was made a fellow. What does it mean? I think it's great. It shows that IBM really supports me and they really value my work. So I'm really looking forward to see where it goes.
For people who haven't listened to episode 82 about quantum experience, can you talk a little bit about what it is? Because what we're going to talk about in the main body of the podcast kind of builds on the quantum experience.
Yeah, sure. So the IBM quantum experience was the first public available quantum computer. And I recommend that anyone that hasn't tried out quantum computing, go and have a go. Currently, there's two public 5-qubit versions and a 16-qubit version. And for our IBM Q network, there's up to a 20-qubit version. For these small versions, the 5-qubit version, there's also this what we like to call a composer. And this composer allows you to draw circuits, which we like to joke around and call a score, and it allows you to drag and drop them and place them anywhere. And then you can actually run these quantum circuits and see what they give. So for instance, if you want to see and learn something about superposition of entanglement, you can make simple circuits that show you how to do that. And I think it's great because there's a user guide that walks beginners through these concepts, and it really allows them to explore quantum randomness and entanglement.
So one of the things when we talked about this some months back was it's not a simulation or anything. When a person works on a little piece of code on their own computer, it gets sent off and ends up on a physical machine in your, is it in New York or is it somewhere else?
Yeah, so they're all in New York, and yes, it's a real device. So they work on their scores or their quantum circuits, and when they're done, they submit them to the machine, and then we process it and load it up and play these waveforms, and the user gets back the shots. I think it's been really good. I think when we talked in October, there was only like something like 19 papers and maybe 100,000 executions. Now, I think we're up to like 85,000 users and there's over 80 papers. So to me, this is really showing that users are finding this of value. And I think we've seen up to about 4.5 million executions that are being run. So I think this is showing how fast this community is growing. And if you really want to get into quantum, you have to go and download the Qiskit framework, which allows you to access the larger devices rather than this drag and drop mechanism.
So you were talking about back then a 5 and a 16, but I think, has IBM hit about the 50 qubits relatively recently? Or is that on the way still?
The 50 is still in prototype. We're going to make it available to our IBM Cube network clients in the next generation. Currently, they're on the 20-qubit system, which we've called the IBM Q Tokyo.
You mentioned a thing called Qiskit, and that's probably what we're going to spend most of our time talking about for the rest of the podcast. So it's spelled Qiskit. What does that mean, let's say, from an acronym, and what does it mean more broadly?
Yeah, so I want to try and stay away from acronyms, but originally what it meant was Quantum Information Science Kit. But what has Qiskit evolved into? It's evolved into an open source quantum computing framework, and it really allows users to write quantum experiments, programs, and applications. And we're trying to make it designed to allow quantum computing for everyone to get in and use. Users can run simple quantum mechanics effects such as entanglement to complicated algorithms. I think in the latest update, which we'll talk about later, of Qiskit Aqua, users can run AI and chemistry, and it can really start to allow you to build and run programs on quantum computers. So Qiskit is really built with modularity in mind. By this, I mean we're hoping that it's easy to extend and add new features. At the heart, It's easy to add different types of compilers, easy to add different algorithms, and it's easy to plug in new devices or backends like simulators or extra real devices. So I haven't really said what QuizKit is, but basically at the moment, it comprises of two important elements. The first is what we like to call QuizKit Terra, and the second is what we like to call QuizKit Aqua. And there will be soon a QuizKit Air and a QuizKit Ignis, basically forming the four elements of QuizKit. I like to joke that the fifth element is the quantum computer, and the ancient Greeks had it right with the four elements. So Terra, as you know, means the element of Earth. And what this part of QuizKit is the foundations. It's the element that we use to allow the users really to execute their programs. I don't really, as I said, want to use acronyms, but we like to be a bit silly and joke around, and we say it stands for transpile, execute, and retrieve results asynchronously. So what does that mean? So basically, if you want to run a quantum algorithm and you want to run it on some hardware, you need to be able to map your algorithm to that hardware. So the transpiler is the part that takes a circuit that a user is specified for any connectivity and tries to map it into a circuit with some constraints. And these constraints can be the connectivity or any other extra thing that the hardware is provided. So the next part is working with a different type of simulator or a different backend. And we've provided this provider, which we've done to allow you to handle this easily. These provider can allow you to easily add in different types of simulators that simulate the experiment in different ways. These simulators could be adding noise to the simulation, calculating state vectors and things like this, or ultimately the real device. And then after we've actually provided our results to this backend, the next part is to get the results object from the hardware and start the analyzation. So the QuizKit Terra component is what I like to think is the foundation that allows a user to take some circuit they want and return the output from that circuit. Now, there's probably many people out there that don't know what a quantum circuit is or how quantum circuits can be used in algorithms. So this gets to our next element, which I like to call aqua. Aqua is Italian for water. And since water is fundamental for bringing life to many things, we like to joke around that this is what brings life to QuizKit for applications. Like Terra, we have an acronym for it as well, and the acronym for it stands for Algorithms and Circuits for Quantum Applications. But like Terra, it's designed to be extensible, and it also uses a pluggable framework where different algorithms can be added in. And currently, it supports the user to be able to experiment in chemistry, AI, and optimization. I say it's really still pro beta, but it's open source and available to download. And it sits on top of the Terra and abstracts the circuits away so the user can start to program with not knowing too much about quantum. It has both a programmable and graphical interface and some chemistry extensions. These extensions are, in my opinion, key because they allow you to link into standard libraries. The ones that we've linked into are Cy4, Gaussian, PyQuanti, and these are libraries that people have used for a very long time to study quantum chemistry. And now what we're doing is allow the user to enter their problem in these libraries and then, say, map it to a quantum device. And this allows people to start to explore how you would run on these noisy, intermediate, scalable quantum devices, which we've, following from John Prasco, we're calling NISC. I think in the last time we spoke, I was calling approximate, but defining this as a NISC architecture. Then the last part about QuizKit that we have there is we have many tutorials and list many Jupyter notebooks. I think you can even go online and run them through an online Docker and start to explore, and you can really start to see how to program with quantum.
When you were coming up with QuizKit, did you have particular problem spaces or industries in mind, like pharmacy or pharmacological or chemistry, mathematics, something like that?
I think when we're coming up with it, we wanted to focus firstly on how to give the users the ability, the researchers and the developers that really want the fundamentals of quantum circuits, the ability to control these circuits plug in different types of parsers and different types to compile it to different hardware so they can start to really exploit how to run them better on real hardware. The problems that seem most natural for quantum are ones that are difficult for a classical computer. And these are generally ones that either classical has difficulty in simulating, like chemistry. It's very hard for a classical computer to predict the energy because it has to take in of a molecule, because it has to take into the many configurations of the different electrons. And the other problems that we're getting really interested in is AI and machine learning, and trying to work out how we can use a quantum computer and exploit the large Hilbert space it has for these types of problems. And the third part that I mentioned before is optimization. And this is trying to look at optimization problems with quantum computing. This one is a little bit more difficult to see how quantum will be better than a classical, because it's easy to write down the answer for an optimization problem. But the hope is that you can use entanglement to explore the energy landscapes of these optimization problems in a more efficient way. And at the moment, it's still not clear whether there is a quantum speed up for that.
If I were to say to you, you know, compared to running my simulations on your 20-qubit machine or on if 50 becomes available, why is Qiskit important? Why don't I just run it against the real hardware?
Allows you to run it on the real hardware. If you were, if you wanted to do, like, run straight on real hardware in a lab, you have to know how waveform generators work. So Qiskit is really a framework to allow you to run these things on the real hardware. So why I think it's important is the Terra allows the user that is really wants to know more about the hardware to be able to go lower into it and start to dig deeper into the stack and learn how to optimize the circuits. And Aqua, I think it's important because it's established two different things. I think the first is trying to get domain experts that are not familiar with quantum computing to come in and work out how to optimize the circuits, the standard ways of doing chemistry research and things like that. And the second is this is the way to increase the user base of Qiskit. So I think I'd like to think Terra really applies to people that want to understand the hardware, and Aqua allows researchers and developers to contribute new algorithms with much little understanding of how the hardware works. So I think this is where the developers will really be able to come in, and without the low-level understanding of the quantum devices, be able to add cool new features that us physicists probably have failed to see.
Qiskit, it sounds like it's been made, it is available, it is out there. So who's using it, and what are the practical things they're using it for already?
Yeah, it's out there. Anyone can use it. It's open source and it's free to use. I think a lot of people are starting to use it, and we're starting to see a lot of things grow. We've had, since I think we talked last time, we've had many more external people from IBM start to contribute to the open source. We've started a Slack channel where people can come in and discuss. And I've seen everything from people working out how to make their own add-ons to Qiskit that can be extra backends that the providers support. These could be simulators and optimized in different ways. And I think we're really starting to see an increased number of researchers and developers engaged in seeing what quantum computing to do. So to answer your question, I think anyone can use it. To run it on the real hardware, you're going to have to register an account on the IBM Quantum Experience, and you'll be able to use the public devices that are 5 and 16 qubits.
You mentioned 21 as well. So what do you have to do to get access to the 20-qubit machines?
Yeah, so the 20 qubits are part of our IBM Q network. And we like to refer to them as our premium devices. To get access to them, you have to be a member of the IBM Q network.
What is an IBM Q network?
The IBM Q network is a collection of companies and academic institutions, government labs, and startups that want to explore quantum computing. They're experimenting and collaborating and working out what quantum computing can do.
I recently had Michael Brett of QBranch on the podcast, and their company is looking at the commercial aspects of quantum computing. Are they the kind of company that are part of the Q network?
Yeah, so QX Branch is one of the startup members of the IBM Q network. I'm sure they're looking at Qiskit, and Qiskit Terra will be how they work with our devices. Qiskit Aqua just came out recently, so I'm not sure if they've had that much time to look in and how it uses, but I'm really looking to see what they can do working with us.
With companies like QBranch, and I presume other companies out there, I think Samsung and maybe some banks, do you think we are entering the start of a commercial quantum computing period, or are we still very heavily in research and development?
Well, I think the answer is yes. It is starting to enter commercial. But to be honest, I don't really know what people mean with commercial. I think at the moment, there are definitely a lot of, as we talked about before, interesting companies that are interested in seeing what quantum. And I think we're really at the stage where we're trying to understand what these NIST quantum computing devices would do. But we're definitely seeing an interest in the industry. And I think within the next few years, we'll discover areas where we can start to see some quantum advantage.
I know that Microsoft have their own quantum group. I think it's called Station Q. I presume, do Google, do Amazon, do other large tech companies, or are there other big commercial ventures out there along the lines of what IBM is trying to do? And I'm not saying that you're trying to do a big commercial thing, but to get to the point of building quantum machines that are available commercially.
I think there are many companies interested in quantum. Google has a hardware team. Microsoft has a software team. So yes, they are definitely interested in seeing what quantum can do. What we have is the full stack, where you can go from applications to compilers to hardware. So it's getting very competitive time where these companies are getting very interested in seeing what quantum computing can do.
Again, sticking with kind of commercial side of it, what do you think maybe, in 5 years' time, commercial quantum computing will look like? You know, is it going to be people buying physical machines to have on premises, or will it be more cloud where you rent some time or submit a job?
Well, I think the answer is yes. It is starting to enter commercial. But to be honest, I don't really know what people mean with commercial. I think at the moment, there are definitely a lot of, as we talked about before, interesting companies that are interested in seeing what quantum. And I think we're really at the stage where we're trying to understand what these NIST quantum computing devices would do. But we're definitely seeing an interest in the industry. And I think within the next few years, we'll discover areas where we can start to see some quantum advantage.
And then I suppose it'll be the big players again, the IBMs, the Googles. Are you aware of any smaller commercial companies out there, or do you think it takes the massive resources of the likes of the big companies?
Okay, yeah, there's a very active startup community out there, but I think quantum computing is going to require a lot of skills and a lot of over many different areas, and I think it was going to require somewhere like IBM to achieve this.
But IBM, though, have a very different approach also. So you're not just looking at the kind of open source and the commercial. Your company is doing a massive amount of research, and I know that you're personally involved in that. So can you give us a flavor of what you've been doing?
Yeah, so I think, so we do a lot of research, yes, and we're trying to work out exactly what quantum computing can do. A big part of our research involves working out how we can benchmark these systems. So how do we come up with tests, building the right devices? And then I spend a lot of time researching in how we can actually come up, improve the gates, because ultimately at the end, the devices, it's not so much the number of qubits, it's the fidelity that matters more. And that's how well we do the gates. And we need to make sure the fidelity keeps improving. And we're working on different ways that we can continually to push what we like to refer to as the quantum volume, which is a measure of both the fidelity and number of qubits that tells you how much of the quantum device you're actually using. And then other research that I'm working on is working out how we can use and explore these NIST devices with heuristic algorithms. Last year, we put out a paper showing how we could explore chemistry, and we mapped out a few orbitals of small systems, and we're working on extensions to that at the moment.
I know that you've had published a paper in Nature on simulating a molecule. Was that done with the hardware that we've been talking about, the 20s, the 16s, the 5s, and the prototype 50, or is that done in some different way?
Yeah, so that was done with an internal device, but the same, if you want to explore everything that can be done with that device, sorry, if you want to explore everything that can be done with that paper, we've given you a notebook where you can actually run those same experiments that we did on the devices in the public.
What kind of research do you think you're going to be performing as you kind of, as you hit the 50, let's say, or the 100 qubits computers?
Well, again, we're going to take the number off the number of qubits. What's going to be more important is making sure that we can keep reducing the error rate. So the research for the 50, for the 20, or the 100 is still going to be very similar. It's how do we make sure the fidelity of the operations in the presence of many qubits continues to improve so that we can run longer and longer quantum algorithms. And this, I would say, is the biggest part of my research, understanding what is our limitation and how do we remove it, how do we make it better so that we can explore longer algorithms.
And that is something that I imagine it is improving. Is it year on year, would you say?
Yes, I think since I started this field, our coherence was very, very small when we first made these transmons. And one of the reasons I'm very excited about this is we look back and look at the progress of either the coherence rate or the error rate. You can plot it, and it looks like it's following an exponential curve showing the improvements that we and the community are making to make quantum computing devices better.
If I was to ask you sort of the difficult question of predicting the future of quantum, where do you think the industry would be or the research community would be, let's say, in 10 years, if you want to hazard a guess?
10 years is a long time.
Sure.
So it's really hard to predict. I think where we will be definitely within that time is understanding how much error correction we need. So I've talked a lot about improving the error rate. And there's probably some limits that are imposed by physics that, well, there isn't some. There are definitely limits that are imposed by the physics of these devices that will say the error rate won't always just get better by removing. There might be some fundamental barriers. But what the field has shown in error correction is by having the software interacted with the hardware. This is only theoretical, of course, that you can start to exponentially suppress these error rates by using more qubits. And I think within the next 10 years, we'll understand really the full overhead of what we need to make error-corrected qubits, which is sometimes referred to as logical qubits. And then using these error-corrected qubits will allow us to push these algorithms out to longer and longer times. I don't like to think that there's this strong transition that you're just physical qubits, and then one day we'll have logical qubits. I think it's going to be slow over that time, and you'll be working out how to use extra qubits around to remove some of the errors on the path to working out what the code is that works best on these devices. So in the next 10 years, I think we'll really understand error correction, and we'll really understand what we need for a quantum advantage, and we will have shown a quantum advantage on some type of system. So I'm really optimistic that within 10 years, quantum computing will be everywhere. I'm hoping it'll be taught in classrooms and it'll really become a new technology and a community that everyone is learning.
And I presume you'll be sticking with the topic, Jay?
Yeah, I've invested a lot of time in this and I continue to do it. Often I find myself after I spend my work days basically like meeting with people, discussing what we should do next, thinking about the different types of problems that we should look at. I often find myself at night finding some time to program because I really like to program, and finding myself in the communities that we've developed answering questions. So I'm definitely committed to seeing this technology succeed.
Any final notes before we wrap up for the evening, Jay?
Yeah, so I think my final thing is I really encourage people to go out there and try the quantum experience, try our quiz kit, and really come to our Slack channels and talk to us and let us know what features or bugs you see. And if you're still not sure how to get into quantum, I would try this Hello Quantum app that was recently made by IBM in collaboration with Professor James Wooten. It's a set of puzzles. I went through them when I got a beta version of the app, and they're fun. They let you to try and solve quantum puzzles and understand quantum in a different way.
Well, Jay Gambetta, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thanks.
If you like this episode, you might also like to listen to episode 68, where Michael Biersik gives a general introduction to quantum computing. Or listen to episode 82, also with Jay, on the IBM Quantum Experience. Or episode 98 with Michael Brett from QBranch about the prospects for commercial quantum computing. The opening music was Return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Big Blue by Poddington Bear from the album Uplifting.